a one-time change.
I'm not going to be here tomorrow. Yeah.
Suggest that if someone sleeps.
Whatever you can, okay. Yeah.
Suggest if someone sleeps on a bed and there's food under the bed, that there's a question as to whether one can eat food after because of reasons of time. So what's the deal with bunk beds? Let's say you have someone who's over bar mitzvah. I'm assuming that's when you start having tummy issues, or maybe even under bar mitzvah?
No, even under.
Okay, so what's the status of the person on the bottom? If someone is not sleeping, they walk under the bottom bunk bed and then walk out, or they don't have tummy?
Yeah, it's not a problem for people. It's only a problem for food. It really is a very limited halacha, and according to many opinions, it does not apply to food that is covered, that's in containers. Although that's a machlokas, so if it applied to fruits, it would apply to things that are just exposed. So the person is okay. You're all right. Yeah.
I've heard the Rav mention once that you no longer axe a Petar Chamor in the back of the head.
You no longer what?
You no longer axe a Petar Chamor in the back of the head.
I don't think we ever did it that often. Basically, the Torah gives you two options. The Torah says, it doesn't give them equal options. It says you are supposed to redeem the Petar Chamor. If you don't redeem, then you break its neck in the back. So the Torah clearly indicates that the preference is to redeem. So the few times that we do the mitzvah today, it's not that common, but sometimes people want to do it, is we redeem it by giving the Kohen a sheep. But theoretically, the halacha is in full force. If you didn't redeem, you'd have to kill the chamor even today. By the way, in case any of you are interested in buying a donkey and doing this mitzvah, remember that the sheep that you give a kohen to redeem a donkey is not a korban, it does not have kedusha. So there's no problem with that. You give the kohen a sheep. The kohen now has a pet sheep. He can do whatever he wants with it. He could shecht it, get it shechted. He could keep it as a pet. In other words, it doesn't have any of the problems that a firstborn sheep would have, which would really be a very, very difficult halacha of it being a korban. That's not the problem with the pigeon, petra chamor. Yeah.
I saw in one of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith, that he says that somebody needs to believe, one needs to believe that Hashem acts with Hashem rewards and punishes based for his actions. I was wondering, Lamaisa, how do we look for rewards and punishments in our life, or how should we?
Well, it's very important to understand that the principle of ultimate reward and punishment doesn't mandate that it takes a particular form. In fact, Chazal teach us that most mitzvahs are not rewarded in this world. In fact, we have tzaddikim suffer in this world, either as an atonement for whatever sins they commit, so they'll get more olam haba, or to give them more reward because they serve Hashem with difficulties. So reward and punishment is never understood on a one-to-one correlation. Hey, I was good today, so I should get more money in my bank account. It just means there's an ultimate cheshbon, an ultimate accounting, in which Hashem will reward you for all the good that you've done and will punish us for all of the bad that we've done. But it could take a million different forms. So the fact that bad things happen to a person in this world is the great mystery of what Chazal call tzaddik v'ra'lo. Why do tzaddikim suffer? But it's not at all a contradiction to the fundamental principle of reward and punishment. Okay. In fact, that's a big problem people have sometimes, maybe more so in Israel, where people like to correlate. So if God forbid, Baruch Hashem, I didn't hear anything about negative. Well, let's say a bus turns over. So somebody will say, oh, this is a punishment because the parents are Mechallel Shabbos. Well, you know, once you start going with that logic, then, you know, what about, you know, great Gedolim that gets sick? You know what I'm saying? I mean, you want to make it a punishment when it's somebody who's not so good, suffers. But then you have the identical thing for people that are good. Baruch Hashem, I have not heard any type of attempt to say those things with the three boys that were captured. But that's a very big mistake. We're not Nevi'im. We don't have the right to say that this happened because of a particular thing. Only a Navi or Chazal could say such a thing. So reward and punishment is much more of a general idea that everything will be adjusted, but we can't really apply it on a one-to-one basis. It's not within our koach.
Is there an idea that one should assess these deeds? Is that
That's always the case. The Gemara says, whenever anything happens to you, you ask yourself, what might Hashem trying to be teach me? Now, let me emphasize, what might Hashem be trying to teach me? I don't know for sure, but I would say the following. Mimanafshech, it never hurts to do tshuva, because if that's the reason this thing happened to you, then you're addressing it. And if it's not the reason, at least you're doing tshuva. In other words, doing tshuva in response to difficulties in life is only a positive proposition. There's no way it could be negative, but you do have to know that you don't know for sure, you know, you can't make this judgment. I remember a story about Rav Isser Zalman that always struck me, how Tzaddik really lives in a different type of way. That one time he was taking a nap in the afternoon, he came home and his Rebbezin was taking a nap. And when he came home, he smelled there was gas in the house. And, you know, had he not come home at that time, he could have died in her sleep because of the gas in the house. So after he opened the windows and they woke up his Rebbezin, and Baruch Hashem, everybody was okay, he asked his Rebbezin, what chait have we done that we have to do tshuva for? Now, to me, it's an amazing thing, because that kind of implied, you know, we must have done one thing wrong, and, you know, let's figure it out. If this thing happened to me, you know, it wouldn't be like, you know, what's the one thing? You know, it's like millions of them, I don't know, you know. So the point is that Tzaddik, like, can identify, because of Tzaddik, you know, lives such a high life of holiness. He has a relatively few number of averus to choose. Unfortunately, we have a very wide selection. So we try to do a little tshuva on all of them, the best that we can. Yeah.
I heard that the Sabbath Rebbe had very harsh things to say about Buddha.
How
do we understand that non-focus?
Well, the truth of the matter is, you know, you're talking about Sama Rebbe, who was Nifter in 1970, so I could raise some very similar questions to what's going on right now. The Sama Rebbe was, as Rav Aaron Cutler said, the last of the lions. Sama Rebbe had a shita in which he was merciless against religious Jews, not so much non-religious Jews, who he felt were adopting philosophies and hashkafos that were dangerous. Everybody knows that Sama Rebbe was an extreme anti-Zionist, and as a result, he was critical of religious parties, Agudas Yisrael, which was part of the government, then Haredi parties, etc., because he says they were legitimating a state of Israel before the Mashiach comes, and they were working with people who didn't believe in Hashem. And he didn't bother criticizing those who were not religious, but his criticism was directed totally against religious people that he felt, frankly, may have become apikorsim or kofrim because of their affiliation. It's very, very hard for us to really understand. I mean, this was a hashkafa that he had, and it was rooted in sources. It was rooted in Makaros. And he felt in a generation of confusion, what was needed was clarity. Meaning, sometimes in the interest of Avas Yisrael, you know, we want to embrace people, we want to bring people together. And although he was an Ohev Yisrael himself, but he felt that if that would lead to confusion and a misunderstanding of the Torah's perspective, he needed to be the voice, who was the lonely voice sometimes, shouting the other Hashkafa. That's all I can say. Now, many, many Gedolim did not agree with his approach, right? And as a result, they criticized him, but they all respected him because he was honest, he was consistent. He did not modify his message to please the crowd, and he frankly didn't care if everybody thought he was crazy, because he said what he believed was the emes, and he was a genuine Gadol B'Torah. And as the Chafetz Chaim once remarked, sometimes, even if this Gadol Sashkaf is not accepted by other Gadolim, but it prevented, in other words, an extreme movement in one direction prevents the other movement from falling over on the other side. It kind of kept everybody in the middle. Now, there's the Satmar Rebbe kind of guaranteed that we didn't get too compromising and too comfortable with our connection with the non-religious political movements. Now, I will tell you one thing about the Satmar Rebbe, though. It's very, very, I think I may have mentioned this story before, but it's a very cute story. I don't know if any of you remember, this is way before you were born, Hubert Humphrey, was a Democratic senator from Minnesota, a great, great liberal, a classic liberal, a great supporter of Israel. He was Lyndon Johnson's vice president, and in 1968, it was Humphrey versus Nixon. They were Humphrey was running for president, Richard Nixon won, but the Democratic nominee was Hubert Humphrey. And Humphrey thought he was, and Humphrey did get most of the Jewish vote because Humphrey was, number one, a liberal. Jews were liberal. Number two, he was Democratic. And number three, he was a big, big supporter of Israel. And this was right after the Six-Day War. So Humphrey wanted to do a lot of campaigning in Brooklyn, where he would speak to large Jewish crowds about how much support he had for the state of Israel. So some scheduler didn't really understand the dynamics of the Jewish community, so they set him up in Williamsburg, the Satmar Rebbe, where Humphrey was going to talk about, you know, how great the state of Israel is and how he supports the state of Israel. And this is a whole group of Satmar Hasidim who are totally against the state of Israel. So they realized at the last minute that this was kind of a bad move, that Humphrey might alienate this whole crowd. They might walk out of them. Who knows what they would do. But it turns out that Humphrey is talking, and the Satmar Rebbe is there, and there's a translator. And Humphrey is talking about Israel and Zionism and the Zionist dream. And in 1948, you know, he was dancing around with the Jews, and the Israeli army is the greatest army in the world. And some of the Jewish handlers, the Jewish aides who know Satmar, they're getting more and more nervous. But the Satmar Rebbe is smiling and nodding and really very, very nice. And afterwards, one of the Jewish aides goes over to the Rebbe and said, you know, I'm really sorry, Rebbe, there was a mistake here. We realized that this is something that upset you. And he said, not at all. But we know your position on Zionism. He said, that is a family disagreement. That is a disagreement I have with my family, my fellow Jews, but they're still my family. And he said that I'm very happy when Jewish soldiers don't get hurt. Meaning he was against Zionism, he was against the state of Israel, and he was against even the victory of the Six-Day War. You know that in Turikarta, Satmar, they do not go to the Old City. They do not even go to the Old City because they consider it in a legitimate conquest from the Arabs in 1968. They don't recognize that conquest. But it is said that he fasted during the Six-Day War, and he was already very old and very sick, in order that Jewish soldiers should not die. So this is more complex than you would think. The ideological hashkafic disagreement never turned into hatred and a lack of Rav Hashem, even in Satmar, as it were. But that's the idea that of Satmar and Aguda, that it was a machlokas l'shem shemayim. Everybody knew the Satmar Rebbe was a great, great tzaddik and a kadosh, and he had a particular style, a particular approach that most gedolim did not accept. Yeah.
I was wondering if Rob could, I guess it's maybe if you've heard of it, but I once heard it from another place, but they're talking about where you see it not through earpiece or like a microphone.
Yes.
And maybe, I know the story heard there would be a lesson, and he took out his hearing aid and he used a tarot.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, this is a very, very fundamental question. And actually, can a person be yotzei any mitzvah that requires hearing? Let it be tekiyat shofar, let it be kriyas hamagila. Then, of course, you don't have a Shabbos problem. But on Shabbos, too, if you hold, you're allowed to wear a hearing aid, that raises a whole other question. And it's really analogous to some degree. Can you be yotzei with a telephone? Right there, let's say a person might have a parent in a hospital or a nursing home, right? You say, can you make Havdalah, for example, for a parent via a telephone? And it's a big, big machlokas of poskim, but many, many poskim do basically say that not only is a telephone not a valid way of being motzi, but even a hearing aid is not, because you're actually not hearing the direct sound, meaning the following. What happens basically is the sound waves are converted into electrical impulses. Now, in a telephone, that's clearly the case. In a telephone, basically, the sound is converted electronically, and the electrical impulses are transmitted through wires, and then they're reconverted into the replication of sound at the other end. So you're actually not hearing the direct sound. You're hearing a replication of the sound. It's almost like a recording of sorts. Certainly, you're not yotzei mitzvah by a recording. Well, although a hearing aid, obviously, the sound traverses a much shorter distance, just, you know, a half an inch or a quarter of an inch or whatever it would be. But some poskim say it's the identical process. And as a result, those who are capable of hearing at all would take off their hearing aids. Now here's the thing. If a person is totally deaf, then you might as well hear the Megillah by a hearing aid if the choice is not to hear it at all, because maybe you are Yosei. But if you want to be 100% Yosei l'chol adeos, and you're capable of hearing, you should take off the hearing aid. Again, let me remind you of a Mishnah Maseches Rosh Hashanah. The Mishnah Rosh Hashanah is really the source of this. And it just reminds us that even though the Gemara does not talk about electricity, but everything is based on the Yesodus in the Gemara, the Gemara talks about somebody who blows shofar in a deep hole, in a deep well or something, that has an echo. So the Gemara says, if you hear the shofar sound, you're Yotzei. If you hear the echo of the shofar sound, you're not Yotzei. And the question then becomes whether hearing aid or telephone has the status of echo. And many says yes. Many say yes, because the electricity is reconverted into the replication of a voice. Okay, that would be the issue. Yeah.
I was wondering if the Rav could tell us about, midrasa. A father is allowed to marry off his very young daughter.
Yes.
Just sort of the morality of that, and is there actually a bia in that marriage?
This is difficult. You're 100% correct. Under Torah law, a father has the absolute right to marry his daughter off to a man, even without her consent, and he can do so from the time that she is the age of 3. He can do it between 3 and 12 and a half. At the age of 12, she becomes a nara, which is an adult, but she's still under the domain of the father. At 12 and a half, she's totally an adult, called a bogeris, and the father cannot marry her off without her knowledge. In fact, she has to be the one who marries herself off. But the father can do it from 3 to 12 and a half without her consent. First, let me point out that this was not perceived necessarily as immoral. Marriage in the ancient world was a way that girls were protected. They were given a husband who would protect them, economically support them, so it was considered to be a proper thing. Now, the Gemara already says, though, already in the time of Chazal, already in Chazal's time, Rav said it is forbidden for a father to marry off his daughter as a ketana, because if she is too young to express her desire to marry this person, then the father is doing a sin by putting her in a marriage that may result in hatred and dispute, right? So it's interesting. Torah says it's allowed. Chazal says it's not allowed. But then Tosfos says, in Rabbeinu Tam's time, our minhag is we do it. Because, Tosfos says, the position of the Jewish community is so precarious and so dangerous. And we are financially so unstable because the goyim could take all of our money, that if we don't marry off our daughters at the first opportunity, we don't know there'll be a chance for them to get married later. So in the time of Tosos, they went back to the child marriages, but then after that period, we don't do it anymore. Now, there was a story in New York, you may have heard, about a guy. This really created real trouble. He was in a divorce fight with his wife about custody. So he went and he claimed that he married off his daughter to some guy, and he had 2 witnesses. But he would not reveal who the guy was unless the wife conceded something about custody. That would have left his daughter. It shows you the riches of people in these disputes, because that would have left his daughter, who was like 11 years old, unable to marry anybody because we don't know who her husband is. And it came out that Shlomo Zalman was still alive then. It came out that they did issue a psak that the marriage was not valid. He could not, if he did not bring forth the witnesses, we don't have to assume the marriage is valid, etc. Different thing. Now, the question you're asking me is, what were these marriages consummated? It's hard to have detailed statistics. I will tell you that in Europe, when they would marry, they wouldn't marry minors, but girls would sometimes get married at 12 or 13. And the boys would get married at 14. It was common. The minhag was there was no consummation until like 16 or 17. So I'm assuming that even when there were child marriages, there was a delay in consummation. But I don't have the exact numbers on that.
Yeah. In the previous discussion, I asked about Arabs having control over the oil, and as I mentioned in the Torah, it came up in that discussion that Ishmael has the kale.
Yes.
They're the only other nation with the power of monotheism.
Yeah.
It's sort of bred into them.
Yep.
And as a result, they have a certain spiritual power that no one else has.
Yep.
Now, isn't it true that the ancient Egyptians and other serious pagans also had the spiritual power, like serious spiritual power, in spite of being polytheists?
Well, yes. You're correct. The Egyptians were capable of sorcery, of magic, and according to most Rishonim, these were not optical illusions. These were not hypnosis. These were not illusions or mirages. These were actual manipulation of deviant spiritual forces. But once again, I didn't mean to suggest that you can't have spiritual forces via Avodah Zarah Mamish. But all I can say is that the forces that one gains by connection to the ultimate source of the unity of God will be much more powerful than anything else. So you kind of have a hierarchy here. God has many subordinate powers, and you can tap into those subordinate powers and do a certain amount of stuff. But if you tap into the power of God, that kind of empowers you more. But then there's an empowerment based on a holy relationship with God and an empowerment based on a profane relationship with God. So I would say there are kind of three, I mean, more than this, but there are kind of three levels. There's the tapping into the subordinate forces. There's the tapping into monotheistic forces, but not through an approach of holiness. And then there's the Jewish ability to tap into the powers of God through the powers of holiness. So I would think there's that hierarchy. You are correct. Avodah Zarah, it's hard for us to understand all these things because we're not really privy, we're not really familiar, we're not really knowledgeable about the spiritual dynamics of the universe. Now, we talk the language of spirituality, we talk the vocabulary of it, but we're not really much aware of things beyond the physical in terms of these extra physical powers that do exist in the world. But it's very, very clear that this world is only a tiny little fraction of the powers that truly exist. And there are people who can tap into these powers behind the matrix, so to speak. And some of the people who tap into those powers can be very evil people, and some of the powers themselves can be demonic powers. So it comes from different places.
Is there a concept of the share mentioned in the Torah, or maybe different views of the conventional sense we understand it?
Well, of course, the notion of Basher, that Hashem has decreed for every person who their partner is in life, that's in Chazal. Chazal say 40 days before a person is conceived, God decrees who is supposed to marry whom. Now, that doesn't mean you'll get your Basher, and that doesn't mean you can't have a good marriage without your Basher. In other words, this is a very tricky question. Basher doesn't mean it will happen, and even if it doesn't happen, you can still, through your Bechira, make a good Shidduch, but it does mean that you didn't get the absolute most perfect. Okay, but once again, okay, well, one can do okay with not the most perfect either, and one shouldn't go crazy, so to speak, thinking, gee, maybe my wife is not the most perfect, maybe there's somebody more perfect. You take what you have in life and you work with it, and you can make a beautiful thing. Now, is there a direct reference to a notion of Basheret in the Torah? I would say we don't have a direct reference. We certainly do see some marriages where the hand of Hashem is very, very apparent. And of course, the outstanding example is Yitzchak and Rivka, when Eliezer asks for a sign and asks for a test, and that is exactly the woman. Now, even then, it doesn't say she was destined from birth. We don't see that. But we do see that Hashem arranged that Shidduch. And we also see it from the understanding that originally HaKadosh Baruch Hu made Adam and Chava one creature that were separated. And when Adam unites with Chava, he is finding his better half, or at least his half, doesn't say better half, we say, but he is being reunited with the other part of himself. And many, many Svarim say that is what marriage is. You actually find the other half of your soul, and your soul becomes complete. So that would indicate that itself, in other words, the idea that every shidduch is a replication of Adam v'Chava indicates that you are finding the intrinsic part of yourself, which indicates a basheret, because something was taken away from you, and now you're getting it back. So you're getting back what it was that was taken away. But a direct reference we only have from Chazal, not from the Chumash.
Yes.
40 days?
Well, what the Gemara says is 40 days before you're conceived. It is decreed in heaven.
Why is it 40 days younger or older than you are?
No, not necessarily, because the decree seems to be on the man, and maybe the woman hasn't been born yet, meaning it might say 40 days before you were conceived, it was decreed that you're going to marry Esther somebody, but Esther somebody might not be born for 30 years, which is why a person might sometimes have a long wait.
What is the source for Chazal? Where do they get it? Like, do they mention?
Chazal don't always give us a makor, but we have to assume that either it was a halacha l'Moshe Mishinai, in the sense it was a received tradition from Moshe, or Chazal in their wisdom and in their Ruach HaKodesh understood that this is the way the world operates.
There are some Christian groups, particularly in America, that practice speaking in tongues, and they claim that they feel like the spirit of God or Jesus
going
through them, and they do all sorts of like wacky things as a result of that.
Yeah.
Like shaking on the floor and stuff.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that?
I've seen videos on.
Yeah, they also play with snakes, right? They do stuff with snakes.
Yeah. So
sometimes they get killed. It's a dangerous game.
Are they tapping into the Kofas Atuma, or is it just...
I'll tell you the truth. This is not a new phenomenon. We accept the fact that people are experiencing genuine religious feelings. We don't say it's all fake. We don't say they're making it up. Some of it's made up, but even the case when the guy gets out of the wheelchair, some of these are fakers. Otherwise, some of it might be true. And the reason is because we believe that there is such a thing as kochos atuma. There is such a thing as negative spiritual forces. These forces are real, and if one taps into them, things can happen. Even miracles can happen. But because they are coming from impure sources, that for whatever reason God has allowed to exist, they will not bring a person to Hashem, and they will not perfect a person's neshama. So I would have to say that I think speaking in tongues is a recognition that in the practice of Avodah Zarah, there can be ecstasy, there can be genuine, maybe genuine is not the right word, but there can be spiritual experiences, but we would say it's coming from what's called the Sitra Achra, the other side. You see, from a Kabbalistic perspective, we don't have to, I can't say, maybe it is fake, I don't know, but we don't automatically have to say that this is all a put-on, this is all a show, this is all a fake. We can say that what people are experiencing is real, but it's a reality that's not rooted in holiness, and as a result, it ultimately is going to be a destructive force.
Is there a way to distinguish between, ones that are fake and ones that are real?
It's very, very difficult. It's very difficult. A person could go on drugs and also experience a lot of spiritual revelations. Go on LSD or whatever. I remember, LSD is not heard about that much today, but in the 60s, LSD was a big thing, and there were various people who were touting LSD as a way of getting spiritual enlightenment and the like. It's very hard for us to know. As Maminim, we know that we believe that the Derech HaTorah is the way that you achieve closeness to Hashem. And for a non-Jew, it would be via the seven commandments of Noach with a belief in God. And that faith can bring a person to that level of Kedusha. Now, in the case of Christianity, it gets a little more complicated because, as you know, and we've spoken many times, there is a great, great machlokas if we classify Christian worship as idolatry or not. The Rambam treats Christianity as Avodah Zarah, and the Rambam was only familiar with Catholicism, basically. It was pre-Reformation. Rabbeinu Tam says Christianity might be a mistaken religion, but it is not idolatrous. And for a Christian to be a Christian, a believer in Yashka, is not a violation of the seven commandments of Noach. Right? There's a very important machlokes, the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam. So I can't tell you what the halacha is. We're no egg like Rabbeinu Tam. That's why we allow churches in Eretz Israel. Otherwise, we couldn't have churches in Eretz Israel. Of course, how do we have Buddhist temples in Eretz Israel? That for sure is a problem. But I would say this. If one would follow Rabbeinu Tam, then perhaps it's not even kochos atome. It might be a genuinely proper worship for a non-Jew that allows him to connect to God. So whether it's Sitra Achra or not may depend on whether we regard it as idolatrous, pagan, or whether we regard it as a legitimate worship for a Noachite. Now, if you have a Jewish Christian, you know, a Jew who practices, who does this, then I would have to say it's only from the Sitra Achra. There's no way his neshama can be connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam through the practice of Christianity. Vis-a-vis a non-Jew, it would depend on that machlokas, right? So it's not so simple. What are the examples of Avodah Zarah?
Yeah, no, that we have.
Well, many people say that a lot of Eastern religions are Avodah Zarah.
So if a Jew is forced to do the follow, he has to die?
Well, yes. In fact, even Christianity would have to die, because when Rabbeinu Tam says Christianity is not idolatry, he means it's not idolatry for a non-Jew. It is considered idolatrous for a Jew. So a Jew would have to give up his life before he became a Christian.
So in Brachos, I remember discussing that one of the Rebbeim, if someone were to try to do something weird and get in touch with the Zikin, they'll be attacked by them?
Yeah.
I was wondering, is that because they're like inherently evil, or is it because it's just their...
Well, the word mazikim, demons, and of course the Rambam didn't believe in them, and the Rambam says any reference to Chazal to mazikim is a mashal for other things. They don't really exist. The Vilna Gaon has a comment on the Rambam, that the Rambam was led astray by his preoccupation with the cursed Greek philosophy, that everything had to be rational. And the Vilna Gaon says, if Chazal say there are mazikim, then 100% there are mazikim. And somebody asked the Kutzker Rebbe in the 1800s, if there are mazikim, how come we don't see them today? And the Kutzker Rebbe said, for sure there are mazikim, but if the Rambam says they don't exist, even the mazikim respect the Rambam and kind of get out of the way. That's what the Kutzker Rebbe says. But the word mazikim, now we call them shadim or demons, but the word mazikim literally means powers that injure. Mazikim, mem, yeah, mazikim. So consequently, it is the nature of mazikim that they are not friendly creatures. They are there to hurt, they are there to harass. What their mission is exactly is not entirely clear. At some level, it facilitates free will by creating a life in which bad things happen. Even though I do mitzvahs, that tells me I have to choose to do good. It's not going to be an automatic thing that my life is going to be easy. So mazikim are connected to the Bechira world, etc. But you want to avoid mazikim as much as you can, because their job is to make life difficult for you. No, that's what it is, yeah.
As a follow-up to the Bashir question, at the risk of sounding like a bit of a flame to Baal Shiva, does one increase his chance of marrying his Bashir if he listens to his rabbi closely on dating issues and things like that, or is that just sugar?
I would say so, I would say so. Again, not so much because the rabbi has some magical knowledge, but generally speaking, the more you learn, the more you daven, the more you respect the chachamim that you come in contact to, so you're doing the ratzon of Hashem in the Torah, you do the ratzon of Hashem, then you're zochet to what Hashem has set aside for you. Now, if a person is, but again, I do want to emphasize it's a complicated question, because many people might wind up not marrying their bashets. And the people who don't marry their bashets can still have a wonderful, blessed marriage with brachos and with children and with everything else. So one shouldn't think you only have one chance in life, and if that chance is missed, the rest is just going to be failure. There is an optimal situation, so to speak. There is a perfect situation. But if we don't get perfection, we try to make our life as perfect as we can get. So so in a sense, it doesn't really help a person to think too much about Bashir. In other words, you'll either get it or you won't get it. But whatever you get, whatever we get, by the way, on her side as well, she might be getting somebody. it's not like we're perfect, and we're stuck with her. I mean, she might be stuck with us. But the point basically is, whatever you get in life, you have an achrayus and a responsibility to make it as good as you can make it by making the right choices, by living a life of kedusha. So one shouldn't really think Hashem only gives you one chance. Another thing about Bashert that's interesting. A Bashert also doesn't mean that it's supposed to last forever. People sometimes say, well, what if people get married, they get divorced? Sometimes the Bashert was that for 5 years, this is what you needed. And then you have to move on to something else. Right? So even a divorce is not a contradiction to Bashert. Now, so Bashert is a more complicated idea. It's not the pure Hollywood, lasting romance. Yeah.
What is the Torah view on democracy?
Well, Winston Churchill, once said about democracy. Not a Torah source, of course. By the way, I don't know if people know this. It's not that well known. Winston Churchill was actually a High Commissioner of Palestine in the 1920s. Before he became Prime Minister and other things, he actually he lived in Jerusalem. And in fact, his great desire, which he didn't carry out, was after he retired from politics, he wanted to move to Israel and live in Jerusalem. He says he loved the holy city and he was very inspired by living here. In fact, there's a YouTube video, it is really very, very cute YouTube video of Churchill having a reception in the 1920s. It's an old tape. And Rav Kook and Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld had to come to this reception. And Rav Kook and Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld are walking side by side, and they're passing Lady Churchill. And she just sticks out her hand. And you can see Rav Kook, it was a grainy video, but he was just very, very shocked, and he was like paralyzed. And Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld just snuck around. And I'm telling you, I mommy saw that. You could mommy see a grin on his face. He was like grinning at Rav Kook. At Rav Kook's discomfort. But people are going to think, oh, Rav Kook compromised. Rav Kook did not take her hand. Rav Kook did not take Lady Churchill's hand. But Winston Churchill once said about democracy, that democracy is the worst form of government ever invented, except for everything else. So Churchill, of course, is saying democracy is the best thing. Now, halacha is more complicated, because keep in mind that one of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah is that we are supposed to have a king that has ultimate political authority, and there is a mitzvah to have a king, and that suggests actually a bit of a distrust of democracy, simply because people might often not want to follow the Torah, and you kind of need a leader who is butthole to the Sanhedrin, who will impose the will of the Torah. So I would have to say that when you have a proper melech, who's a tzaddik and a righteous person, that would be superior to democracy. However, given the fact that human beings today are not kafuf to the Torah, in other words, given the fact that we don't have a melech that is appointed by a navi, I would say, as a second best, democracy is better than monarchy today, simply because our monarchs, whatever monarch we would have, would not be meshubit to the Torah. And if he would not be meshubit to the Torah, it is better to have as much freedom as you have, because at least in a free society, I can be as religious as I want to be. In a dictatorship or the like, I will find my ability to serve Hashem restricted. So the bottom line is, democracy is not the ideal government of the Torah, but when you're not going to be able to have that ideal government, democracy is preferable to any other alternative. Yeah.
Kaisa, I'm going to ask about is a specific example of a broader principle, but Einstein discovered the science behind the ultimately paved way for the atomic bomb, which killed hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, yeah.
So is he then culpable in some way? Does he receive punishment? And then applying that to more general circumstances, somebody discovers something or vegetable, but not necessarily for negative reasons, but then it is then later used for negative reasons. Do they share, do they get punishment?
Yeah, that's a very excellent question. It's a very thought-provoking question. It would seem that if a person invented something or discovered something or developed something that has a great, great potential for good, and atomic energy does have a great potential for good. You know, atomic energy can resolve all of the world's power issues without oil, without anything, at a fraction of the cost, really, of fossil fuel and without the pollution. If somebody discovers or develops an idea that has a great, great potential for good and had no intention that it be used for evil, and of course Einstein was a pacifist. Einstein certainly did not want this to be used in any destructive way. And other human beings misuse it. I would say that Hashem is not going to hold him responsible, because God judges him by his kavana and by what his desire was. And because human beings have free will, they could take anything good and they could pervert it. You know, Now, I don't love Henry Ford. Henry Ford was actually a vicious anti-Semite, but I was going to say, you know, is Henry Ford going to be responsible for all the people that die in automobile crashes? You know, I would basically say not. I mean, he created something that is of great use to many, many people, has many, many positive uses. The fact that it can be misused is not going to be his sin. And I think that's equally true with, more so with atomic energy.
One more follow-on question: is there ever a case when somebody with completely good intentions can get punished for a sin that was done by complete accident or without any?
Well, there is a concept in the Torah called shogeg, right? If a person does a sin accidentally, he kills somebody accidentally, there's a punishment of going to a city of refuge. Or if I desecrate the Shabbos accidentally, I have to bring a sin offering. Now, all of that suggests that even an inadvertent sin is still a crime for which God will exact some punishment, although not as severe as intentional. However, the poskim differentiate between what is called shogeg and what is called onus. Shogeg refers to accidental sin where I was careless or I should have checked. For example, I'm cutting wood, and the blade flies off my axe and kills somebody. So I have a certain culpability. I could have checked my axe, you know, I could have checked it before I used it. But if something is a totally unavoidable accident, for example, I'm on a building and a flash of lightning, you know, knocks me off the building and I fall on somebody, something that I could not have anticipated, I could not have prevented, that is not called shogeg, that is called onus. And onus, the commentaries say, is not an aveira at all. Hashem does not hold you responsible. So I think we always have to ask the question, only Hashem can judge it, was this a type of sin that could have been prevented had a person been more careful in his research, in his investigation, or is it a type of sin that was totally unavoidable? And if it was totally unavoidable, the person is not responsible, even in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's book. Yeah?
I was curious about just like the parameters of what the things like it's so hard to talk the wellsprings of wisdom opening up, and then nowadays you have so much access to all these very deep core ideas that were never before so accessible.
Yeah.
But at the same time, coming from you share back from like the acres, Gemara, and right. What are the parameters of like being able to do it versus not? How do you understand?
It is a good question. You know, when we talk about Kabbalah, the mystical ideas of the Torah, the inner meaning of the Torah, the panemius of Torah. So one of the things you read about over and over and over and over again is one should not touch these ideas until they have filled themselves up with shas and poskim. In fact, that's always the language. They filled your stomach. Malay kareso. You should fill your belly with shas and poskim. And then we add other requirements too. You have to be at least 40, and you have to be married, and you have to be stable and filled with shas and poskim. And then you can approach the inner dimension of the Torah. But I would say this. I would say you have to understand what we mean when we talk about the inner dimension of the Torah. The type of things that we learn are really just the top of the top of the top of the top. The innermost depths, which involve, you know, tapping into these powerful spiritual forces, can be very, very destructive unless you are grounded in halacha and in Torah, and you're living a holy life. And those are all those warnings. But to kind of get a little bit of exposure to Hasidus, to Kabbalah, to get a taste, that's very, very different. I think that is a good thing for everybody to do. And in fact, the Sforim tell us, as we approach the coming of the Mashiach, we need in our neshamas some of that light to take us out of our darkness. And if the question you raise is, how come earlier generations may have needed it less? The answer is, they were more connected to God. They were not in such deep a hole as we are. They were not in such a dark place. And when you're in a dark place, you need a stronger flashlight. And therefore, the Sforim tell us, in our generation, we need a stronger exposure to the inner dimension of Kedusha, precisely because we're in so much darkness and confusion. So as a result, while all of those warnings about not getting into Kabbalah until you're 40 and until you're married and until you filled yourself with Shas and Poskim, all of those warnings are true. But in terms of the little bit of connection that we have, those warnings don't apply to that type of thing. So, yeah.
So how does that fit with Hasidic for hours and 4,000?
Well, that is, you know, Hasidus has a particular orientation. It was the view of some within the Hasidic movement that once the Baal Shem Tov brought these teachings down to earth, none of those restrictions apply. But even Hasidus is not automatically the deepest levels of Kabbalah. So in a Chabad yeshiva, for example, you will study Hasidus, I think, around 3 or 4 hours a day. I'm not sure. Which is even then, Gemara is the predominant curriculum. Even then, but still, you're taking a huge chunk of the day in Hasidus. But it's not Hasidus from the primary sources. I mean, you're not learning the Arizal. You're learning the talks of the Rebbes who bring it down to earth. So they feel that that's more of a practical type of thing. In the literature world, although we do, we're not against Hasidic Sforim. It's interesting that, you know, Hasidus is encouraged for many, many people, but we don't advocate spending hours and hours on it. You kind of make it a smaller part of your day. So that's a question of how much hours, and that is an important practical question. But I think the general idea that every person should have some connection to the panemius of Torah is a valid thing, even if you're not yet a Bucky in Shas and the like, because that gives a person his Orus, and that gives a person enhanced spirituality, and that gives a person great chizuk in their Avodah Hashem. Yeah. You mean the extra Tehillim?
Yeah, the extra Tehillim.
Yeah, well the Makor of saying Tehillim when we are confronted with Soros, tragedies or sickness, is a very, very old Makor. I mean, there are many Midrashim that say David HaMelech wrote Tehillim so that we should say his words in times of suffering, and Hashem will listen to our prayers in the merit of David HaMelech and in the merit of the holy Kavanos that he put into those words. So any Tehillim is good. Now, why we pick those particular Tehillims is really just because of their context. For example, Tehillim 130, which is Mimamakim, it's even known in the Christian religion as De Profundis, calling up to God from the depths. That refers to a person that is suffering. I'm in deep, deep trouble, and I turn to Hashem in desperation. The other Tehillim that we often say is 121. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. From where shall my help come? So over the years, people have identified special chapters of Tehillim that talk about being in distress, that talk about suffering, that talk about the need for Hashem to help us. So it's really just a question of identifying the Tehillim that seem to apply to our situation. But the minhag of Tehillim, generally B'Eis Sarah, is an old minhag that Chazal already talked about. Is what? I didn't hear you.
Is one of them the Iker?
Oh, of the four levels, Pshat? Well, you need all four. The Gra actually says that Pshat is the key to everything. And he says, after you know Sot, the deepest, deepest levels, only then can you go back and see it in Pshat. So in the simple Pshat is buried all of the great, great secrets. And that's what the Arizal said, the same thing. The Arizal said that, you know, the Ari wrote and taught all sorts of deep Kabbalistic kavanos for davening. It's amazing. If you ever see a Kabbalistic sitter, it's like, you know, 2,000 pages. On Baruch, there'll be 5 pages. And it's not like it's easy to read. You know, we couldn't even read 2 lines of it. You know, Atah, 3 pages. Hashem, 10 pages. And it goes on and on and on that way. And that's why a Kabbalist might take 3 or 4 hours to daven Shemone Esrei. During the week, not on Yom Kippur, during the week. But the Arizal once said, the purpose of all of his complicated kavanos is that he should be able to dive into Hashem the way a 2-year-old baby cries for his mother. But sometimes we need to get sophisticated and deep just to bring ourselves back to the simplest level of connection. The highest level of prayer is to feel like a child connected to a parent. But it's hard for us. We're adults, you know. So we go through this whole process just to get ourselves back into that mode of being a child. So I would say Pshat is ultimately the key to everything. Okay, I'm going to stop here. But anyway, have a good week, and we'll see you at Pshat.